Welcome to Book Waves on Cover to Cover. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Laura Lippman, whose latest novel is And When She Was Good. Laura Lippman is the author of 18 novels in all, 11 in the Tess Monahan series, which we'll talk about, 7 standalone novels, a collection of short stories, an e-book of 3 novellas, and stories appearing in other anthologies, winner of most, if not all, major mystery awards. 20 years reporter, and for 12 of those years at the Baltimore Sun, married to David Simon, which brings an entirely new area, television area, to her work because she has appeared in The Wire. You've accompanied your husband while working on Treme as well in New Orleans, correct?
Yeah, we have a small child. Plus, I love him and want to be with him. So I have lived in New Orleans during most of the filming. It's pretty much coming right down to half and half between New Orleans and Baltimore for us right now.
Before we went on the air, I was mentioning that one of the questions I ask writers of series is, how do you keep a series fresh? After 11 books, the past few books have been written while your husband was working on television. Do you think working with scripts, working with dialogue in that way, and seeing all of that, do you think that influences you and helps keep your own work fresh, or is that kind of irrelevant?
I think it's just a very different thing. I'm one of the few novelists I've ever met who doesn't think it would be easy to write for film or television, who thinks it's very tough. Writing good dialogue in a novel is not indicative that you can write good dialogue for the screen. They're two very different kinds of dialogue, something that Raymond Chandler actually pointed out to James Cain in a letter, because Cain's dialogue, which is brilliant on the page, doesn't actually work that well in film. The worst adaptations of Cain's work have been people who are loyal to a fault. I'm thinking of the remake of Postman Always Rings Twice with Jack Nicholson and Jessica Lange, where some of the intact dialogue made it laughable. Keeping a character fresh, I think it's relevant to note that I have not written about Tess Monahan since the summer of 2009. And the last time she made an appearance in long work, she gave birth. And what I've been telling people ever since that happened is, well, Tess is taking some time off while we work out childcare issues. The fact of the matter is it really raised the stakes in the series. And for Tess to come back, it has to be in a very thoughtful way that is respectful of the fact that she's the mother of a young child now, and that has to change things. But at the same time, you have to be respectful of the fact that you're writing novels of suspense and that your characters are supposed to encounter jeopardy. It's not so much that I worry that readers will be upset if Tess puts herself into dangerous situations. I don't like the idea. I don't think I would approve. And so I've been slow and thoughtful. And I tell people, I'll know how to bring her back when I know how to bring her back. She made a cameo in last year's book, The Most Dangerous Thing. She shows up as a private detective. If you read very carefully between the lines of In When She Was Good, she is in there, as is one of the recurring characters from the Tess series. Pops up. It's a little bit of a surprise. So I'm not going to spoil it for the faithful Tess readers who might read this book. I think it's a great question. How do you keep it fresh? One of the things I did by accident, because I didn't do very much on purpose, I didn't know enough to do things on purpose, I started writing about a very young woman. Tess Monahan was in her 20s when this series began, and she was without a job, she was without a steady relationship, she didn't own her own home. All of those things have changed over the course of the books, and that gave me a lot of material to play with. But now she is in a steady relationship. Her work life has stabilized to a great extent. She has a child. She has a house. I actually am beginning to come around to the idea that series should have endpoints and that writers should know, at least for themselves, when they're going to bow out. You know, Sue Grafton, at the very least, said, I'm writing 26 of these and I'm done.
What made you decide then, and was part of that decision, to give her a kid, because that would change things? Or were you thinking, well, this is a way of keeping it fresh?
I wanted to raise the stakes. I wanted to do something really different. And I knew that I couldn't plan beyond that. It's like, I'm going to give her a kid. I'm going to see what happens. I think it will be interesting. I have, in fact, written one short story about Tess as a mother. It was solicited for a series of stories by the Mysterious Bookshop, and it had to be a bibliophile story. It is by far the coziest, sweetest, least danger-filled story I've ever written. It's about surveillance at a store that's having a lot of theft. And there's no violence in it whatsoever, as a matter of fact. And I wonder, is that the story or is that Tessa's situation? But I think in keeping it fresh, I'm trying to think of who I think has done it best. I'm friends with, but also a great admirer of George Pelecanos. And he simply does not give his series characters that much room to roam in. He starts knowing the endpoint. And, you know, also friends and also an admirer of Dennis Lehane. And I believe there have been only 6 books about Patrick and Angie. I think the person who's come up with the best idea, and I don't think it was a calculation or born of the desire to keep things fresh, but it's working beautifully, and I think it can work for a long time, is Tana French. The setting stays the same. It is the Dublin Murder Squad, but each time a different detective takes center stage, and then the story is done, and that detective moves on. I happened to interview her 2 weeks ago, and she was quite adamant that, no, it would always be a different main character, that some of these characters may come back as secondary characters. We may catch glimpses of them, but she wants the freedom to use up the character, to make them go through something dark and painful and then leave them.
Well, Alan Furst does an interesting thing, which is that each of his books has a different lead character, but he admitted to me once they're pretty much the same one with different names and different backgrounds. Interesting way. Let's change the subject here. Laura Lippman, let's talk a little about And When She Was Good, your latest book. That actually does tie in here because the stakes are, in a sense, the same because we have a female protagonist who has a son who she needs to protect. So that when you're starting there, you're starting again with higher stakes, but then by not being wedded to a particular character, you could take the character anywhere. And, of course, the other part of it is that as we're reading the book, we have no idea if she's going to live or die by the end because she isn't a series character.
It's true. The hope is that the suspense that drives the action of When She Was Good is the suspense that comes from seeing someone in a situation where it looks like wherever they turn, they have a problem. Like, you know, she's been this high-priced call girl, madam, leading a very compartmentalized life now for about 11 years. It has come at a great cost. Now, all of a sudden, oh my goodness, the father of my child, who doesn't even know he has a child, much less that I betrayed him, might be released from prison. And he will come looking for me, and my life will be in jeopardy, and my son may find out the horrible truth about who his father is. I'm aging out of my job, and she's in her late 30s. You know, increasingly the men in her life are saying, you can't do this forever, which she finds insulting but not untrue.
And the cop who's been protecting her is planning to leave as well.
The cop protector who's been key to her life is deciding to retire, and she suddenly realizes how dependent she's been on him, how much he has done for her. All of these things are coming into play, but nothing is more important to her than the fact that she realizes that her son is 11 and he's still relatively innocent, but there will soon come a time when she's not going to be able to hide from her son the truth of who she is and what she does. And that's the motivating factor to get out. The suspense is how? What's she going to do? And what's she going to do about these possible problems that I've just enumerated? And who's going to buy her business, if anyone? How does she stay in the nice suburb, in the nice school district? She doesn't even have a degree of any kind. She's never had any other job other than waitressing.
When you're putting her together, is that happenstance, I'll just throw one more thing in, or is that more or less from the origin of the character of Heloise?
There had been 2 stories about Heloise previous to this novel, so I had a pretty good idea of who she was. I didn't know where she came from. I didn't know the full story. I had given myself pieces of it. I really wanted to write a type of novel in which you see a person surrounded by seemingly insurmountable problems and threats, and the only way out is to turn those threats on each other. Elmer Leonard has written this kind of book frequently. It strikes me as extremely sophisticated and hard to do. I'd never tried it before. I think Donald Westlake has a couple of them too, where, you know, the main character has to find a way to distract all of these various foes, if you will. And while they're distracted by each other, somehow they transcend and get away. It's a really, I mean, you know.
It's complicated.
Yeah, in Westlake's hands, it's a caper book. Often the Dortmunder books were structured that way. And it is very complicated. I mean, I was really interested in the issue of a woman who goes it alone as a parent because that's really hard. And it takes a toll. And I think if you just describe the character to someone, you know, she's in her late 30s. She's essentially been a prostitute most of her adult life. She may have moved from being a low-level sex worker to an extremely well-compensated one who runs a relatively benign organization where her workers get health care, et cetera, et cetera. That's still a really hard life. And yet it's harder still to be a parent, a single parent, who, because of the rigid compartmentalization, cannot avail herself of any of the advantages of community. She is forced by her life to stand apart. She tells herself she likes it that way. She seems to feel somewhat superior to the other women that she sees at soccer games and school. But the fact is she's cut herself off from one of the most valuable resources for a parent, which is other parents.
Do you like her?
I like her very much. I don't like some of the things she has done, actually. And I believe that she has made really big mistakes.
Well, she acknowledges she's made a lot of bad decisions. One other element of the book is the structure, at least for the first two-thirds to three-quarters of the book, which is bringing up her backstory as you're telling the current story. And what that means for you, Laura Lippman, is you have to be very careful about what information you parcel out and when.
I've played a lot with timelines in my work. I really like it. It's something that I probably started to do it, I want to say with What the Dead Know was the first time I really began consciously playing with time and moving back and forth from present to past, from present to past. And one of the tricks I discovered in writing that book is that even if you have the plan that you're going to be moving between or among eras, it's easier if you write the story chronologically. So Heloise is the person we know now, but she wasn't always Heloise. She was born Helen. The reason that the chapters go back and forth is because Helen and Heloise synthesize, if you will. The two strands come together to take us to the breaking point in her life. So I wrote all the Helen chapters first. And then once I knew the Helen chapters, I went back and I mean, I had an idea of what was going on in the present day. I was very clear on what was happening to Heloise. But as soon as I'd written all the Helen chapters, then I could come back and write the Heloise chapters that went in between the Helen chapters. And, of course, there's a lot of rewriting. I mean, in order to give out the right amount of information at the right time, there's a lot of just ruthless revision. And you have to go over it and over it and over it until you know it really well, until you are very... And I actually do these wild charts and things where I kind of show myself with construction paper and little black arrows. There's a chart for this book that's completely non-textual. And there's this tiny little black asterisk that appears early on, and it keeps showing up, and it keeps getting bigger and bigger. And that's one of the really key secrets of Heloise's life that is not revealed until relatively late in the book.
Gives you a real advantage over, say, David Simon's work, because when he's writing season three of Treme, he can't go back to season one.
Right. One of the things that I admire about the writing of The Wire and Treme, and am very familiar with how those shows are put together, although I've never sat in the writer's room and, you know, never attempted to contribute a single thing to it, although I did have the experience of watching Treme last year and watching some of my dialogue come out of a character's mouth, which was interesting.
Wait, what happened?
There had been an incident in which David and I were having just a very comic back and forth. And David said to me, "Do you always have to have the last word?" It was a long pause, and I went, "Not necessarily," which made him laugh very hard. And it was so, it actually made us laugh both so much that I wrote it down in my phone. So I had like the date and time that I'd said it, and I was watching Treme, and the character played by Clark Peters is arguing with his son, and his son says, "Do you always have to have the last word?" And Clark Peters says, "No," and stalks off. And I was like, "Is that? Was that? Did I just end up in Treme?" But at any rate, as I said, I know a lot about the writing process that goes into these TV shows, and it's true, they can't go back. That said, the amount of planning that is done in advance of each season, and really in advance of the show. We talked about keeping a series fresh and that maybe people should know the end point. I will tell you that David Simon and Ed Burns knew the end point on The Wire. They knew how it had to end. Could there have been additional seasons in between? I think given time, they would not have minded if there had been one more season of The Wire in which they'd written about illegal immigrants, because I think they felt like they missed a big opportunity because they were writing about all the broken parts of the system, all the parts of the bureaucracy that no longer work. And with Treme, there's the same attention to detail. Perhaps there are other shows on television, Breaking Bad comes to mind, that are doing the same kind of elaborate long-term storyboarding. But I can tell when shows don't do it. I'll tell you that much. I know the shows that aren't doing it if I watch them. I don't watch as much television.
Getting back to your own work and relating it to that, did you ever feel constrained, say, in books 12 to 15 with Tess Monahan by the fact that, as with season 1, 2, and 3 of something, you can't go back?
You are committed to the world that you created. I'm friends with Harlan Coben, and he once said something about the Myron Bolitar books, which made me laugh, which is, he goes, "If I had it to do it over again, I wouldn't make him an expert in the martial arts," you know. If you had it to do over again, and you don't. And so I think you learn to live with the decisions that you make, and you just say, this is the world. I can't change it. I mean, you can change some things if you're really adamant about it, but I think it's a good discipline to live with the decisions you make as a young writer.
In terms of this book and When She Was Good, Laura Lippman, there was some research, some on prostitution. Did you do any research on how to legitimize a business, or was that completely yours?
When the character of Heloise first occurred to me, which was in the spring or summer of 2001, I always saw that she would be a lobbyist. It was just a funny idea to me, because who has a better reason to be seen out and about with politicians than a lobbyist? And I hope people don't think I'm telling tales out of school, but politicians have been known to use paid sex workers. I had to do a lot of research about what is required of lobbyists in the state of Maryland. I'm lucky in that I have a longtime friend who has worked on The Wire, Bill Zorzi, also appeared as himself on The Wire as a reporter. Zorzi knows everything about state politics, and so he was very good. I mean, he found the idea somewhat incredible, but he was game for the plan of helping me make it credible. You know, the thing that struck me when I did research into high-end madams and sex workers is that they don't usually go to court on sex for money. It's mail fraud. It's not reporting income tax. There may be drug charges, you know, that come out of the kind of business that they do. Proving someone has sex for money is really, really hard outside of a sting operation involving law enforcement. And Heloise has constructed her business in such a way that it's very difficult for anyone to get in that she doesn't know. Okay, so I've created this lobbying business, but what are the other issues? Fine, she pays her taxes, she pays her payroll tax, she files with the state agency that lobbyists file with, and she keeps herself in the middle of the pack so that no one cares about her. I mean, she appears to have no success as a lobbyist, so no one's ever going to go pull that file anyway. I was definitely hearing a rock musician interviewed on Howard Stern. I think it was Sammy Hagar, but I won't swear to that. But he said, and I realized that I was doing all this travel and I was paying a travel agent. So I just started my own travel agency. And I, you know, those points came back to me, the percentage that the agency charged. And I thought that was very funny. And I appropriated that for the book. I created this whole personalized shopping service for her, which was a very coded way of her to let her customer base browse for certain services. I'm really fond of the invention of the so-called hojack, which is the slave bracelet that she makes her girls wear, which has a GPS in it. And they also have to text sort of safety words before and after, which not only assures her that they are safe, but it also is a really good timekeeper. Like if you text at the start of a date and you text at the end of the date, you have a minute for minute accounting. And one of the things I did find out in my research is that high-priced call girl services, they're very serious about the time.
Are you aware that this is a how-to book for pimps and madams?
Well, I would be very flattered if someone tried to follow this. I would love to see if it actually worked. In theory, I can't help it. I'm very proud of my creation. You know, as a novelist, you're trying to make things credible. You're not necessarily trying to make them factual. There is one enormous flaw in Heloise's business plan that would probably sink the business. And that is this idea that you can create an escort service that will not take the impulse or walk-in, if you will. That you can do this with a cultivated base of screen clients. I don't actually believe that's possible. But I think when you read this book and you read about what Heloise does and how she's put it together that way, I believe in the course of reading the book, you will find that, well, yeah, maybe if she were really good at building up a client base, she could do it that way. I mean, we all know people in certain professions who don't take new customers. And of course, that makes everyone desperate to be there. Desperate, like if you hear about the hairdresser who doesn't take anybody new, or the trainer, or in the case of the book, the laundry that doesn't take anyone new. All of a sudden, you really want to be one of those people.
You're listening to an interview with Laura Lippman, whose latest novel is And When She Was Good. As you're writing this, there are political implications. You've said that I think prostitution should be decriminalized, but that traffickers, including pimps and madams like Heloise, should be held accountable. And you put that in the context of legalizing prostitution would create a situation that was extremely difficult for people who were vulnerable, like illegal immigrants.
Yeah, when I started writing, I took a sort of, I would say, purely intellectual view, which is I'm extremely liberal. If that's coming as a shock to anyone at this point, I'm sorry. But yes, I will admit, I am extremely liberal in my politics, and I believe that women should have the right to do whatever they want to do with their bodies. So why wouldn't I be in favor of women being able to sell their bodies by the hour for money? Then I started to do more reading. In particular, there's a very interesting piece in the New York Times in the past year about an area of Spain where prostitution is de facto legal. And people are driving in from France. It's very near the border. And a lot of the women who are working as prostitutes are illegal immigrants, or they're people from places where the pimps say to them, we know where your family is, and we're going to kill your family if you don't do this. If we lived in a utopia where people never exploited other people, then I would say, yes, legalize prostitution. We don't, unfortunately. So I think that the prostitutes themselves should face misdemeanor charges, no jail time, very small fines, but that the people who organize them should be subject to like the full extent of the RICO statutes. I go back and forth on what we should do with the customers. I think we should probably decriminalize their behavior too. Some of my friends, and I actually kind of crowdsourced this. I went to a lot of my friends who are very smart, very solid feminist, and some of them had problems with the idea of decriminalizing the client's role in it. They saw a world in which men are more likely to have money. The capitalism was of interest and distress to them.
And the power, I would guess.
The power. And like, who really does have the power? Is it the buyer or the seller? But I generally feel that prostitution does not harm society as a whole.
Well, it goes back so many years, and people are going to find ways to do it no matter what. And it's been called the victimless crime. And under the conditions where the woman is in power, has the charge,
then it would be victimless. And yes, it's also, there are a lot of confusing messages in our culture about sex and money and men and women. And this is a straight up real quote from a reality television show and it's mentioned in the book, in which a woman announces to the audience of however many million watch the show that you know, she gives her husband oral sex for diamonds. What? and nobody bats an eye. No one bats an eyelash at a married woman talking about the idea that if her husband wants certain sexual favors from her, he's going to have to pay her. And, you know, it's not that long ago in our history that women came with dowries. I think there's still dowries in effect in certain places. And the complicated rules about who gets paid when a couple gets married and who gets paid when a couple gets divorced.
There's also trophy wives, and a lot of trophy wives are marrying for money. Are they prostitutes?
On some level, how are they not? How are we going to define prostitution? It's trading sex for pay. So if a person marries a wealthy person in whom they have no interest other than the wealth, and if it's sort of, okay, I'm going to exchange, I guess it's more than sex, it's also sex and companionship, yeah. And if they're very beautiful, then that's how they're a trophy. But if a person is making a calculation that they are willing to enter into a relationship with someone and have sex, if they then have access to all of the money, think about prenups. Think, you know, that two people sit down before they get married and work out what's going to happen to the money. Now, obviously, that's not a straight up quid pro quo about, and you're going to have sex with me, but it's not like prostitution is standing way out there all by itself, an anomaly that has no connections to the things that are going on between men and women every day. I don't see how anyone can make that argument that it is.
Laura Lippman, you've also said, in terms of your political beliefs, we crime novelists, and I've found this to be the case with almost all the crime novelists I've spoken with, Elroy the exception, are lefty, but the crime novel is conservative as traditionally practiced. The suggestion there, of course, is that the status quo is worth keeping. However, these days, the status quo happens to be the left of the conservative position.
I don't know if we can call that the status quo. I'm not sure what the... I feel like when I quote Dr. Horrible, the status is not quo. I do think that if you have a genre where generally order is restored, you're saying that things are working and order should be restored. I think if you're truly on the left, if you're truly on the left in this country, you don't exactly feel like you're in the mainstream or that the Obama administration is necessarily doing everything you'd like. I also think, though, that as writers began to sort of see that, they began to play with the form a little bit more. And now society, in most of the novels I read in my genre, among the people I like best, things aren't all neat and put back together again. They're chinks. It's like a vase that's been broken into many, many pieces, and you may be able to glue it back together again, but the cracks are still evident, and there may be like a tiny little hole to remind you that it was broken.
See, I look at it slightly differently in that the PI, the private investigator, or the rogue cop, which is most of the cops that we see in these, they're fighting against the system. The system isn't working, which is why they're stepping in. And that's not a conservative approach. The conservative approach would be that the system is working.
Well, I think that, but it's just another system, isn't it? One of the things that is troubling in the genre, is hard to talk about, is the use of vigilantism in the novel, or of committing crimes in order to achieve a greater good. That's really tricky stuff. And there is this thread that's often talked about, particularly in PI fiction. It's about the so-called sociopathic sidekick, where your hero gets to remain pure because there's someone who comes in and does the dirty work. And really, you know,
Walter Mosley.
Also Spencer and Hawk. I'm a little uneasy about this. I'm sure all crime writers take death very seriously. This book has one of the highest body counts I've had in the past 5 years. I've been moving toward trying to write crime fiction where it's maybe at most two homicides, because it's sort of like one death is bad enough. One homicide is bad enough.
Well, you're freed also by having a standalone. I mean, mm-hmm. If you're dealing with Tess, it gets overwhelming. But as long as you're doing a standalone, Red Harvest is possible.
How many people die in Red Harvest? It's a really big number. I will tell you something about the Tess Monahan series. 11 books, she has killed exactly one person. That is very deliberate. It is very thoughtful. And since killing that one person in an incident that left her with an injury that was bad enough to require stitches and leave a scar, in every book or story I've written about her since, you will see a moment in which she is reminded that she has killed someone, and she always reaches down and she touches the scar on her knee. She's never forgotten that, and it shook her very badly. She killed to save her life, but she also killed to avenge the lives of others, and she was conscious of the fact of all the emotion that she put into killing someone. It's a really serious issue to me. It's true that in a standalone you could have a higher body count, I guess. Or that, you know, certainly over the course of a series, if you start counting up how many people have been killed, it can become troubling. And I'm not asking for reality in my crime fiction.
But as you said, you want the semblance of reality. You want people to believe it.
You want it to be credible. I mean, I do think you have to look at certain characters in crime fiction and say, okay, that person has got to be sociopathic by now or have had a complete nervous breakdown. I know that people are not particularly fond of the book Hannibal by Thomas Harris. I have a friend who says it's a wonderful book if you read it as a gothic romance instead of as a crime novel. But you have to credit Harris with the fact that he recognized what was happening emotionally to Clarice, that she did not leave the events of the Silence of the Lambs sort of brushing off her hands and like, well, that's all in the past. Won't be thinking about that going forward. And the idea that she was still sort of linked and that there was something going on there, I give him a lot of credit for doing that because I don't think it was popular, but I think it actually, in some ways, that it was more believable.
Laura Lippman, you were a newspaper reporter for 20 years, and your father, editorial writer for the Baltimore Sun, and you spent 12 years at the Baltimore Sun. You wrote 7 novels while you were still working there. When you began working there, had you been considering becoming a crime novelist?
Well, I'd been considering becoming a novelist since I was about 5 years old. The idea of writing crime novels, it's funny, like, you know, the idea of Heloise comes and has to sit in my head for almost 10 years before the novel comes out. Back when I was working in San Antonio at the long defunct San Antonio Light. And I like to read crime novels, but I'd never thought about writing one. And one of my colleagues said something like, you know who has a good gig? Tony Hillerman has a good gig. I don't think I knew who Tony Hillerman was at the time. I admit it was the 80s, and he's like, yeah, you know, like you pick your city, you pick your character, you write a book a year, that's a good gig. Those words must have taken up resonance somewhere in my brain. But sort of there was other encouragements and incidents that suddenly it made sense to write a crime novel set in Baltimore. I don't think I had anticipated writing a crime novel until that time, which was very early 90s when I started.
Were you married to David Simon? Did you know him at the time?
I met David in 1990. At the time we first met, we were just colleagues at the newspaper. David was either engaged or married at the time I met him, and I was about to be engaged and married. So we didn't really know each other that well. We actually started off on different papers. He was on the morning and I was on the evening paper, and later the staffs were combined. And he was a star already. He just published Homicide, which was about to become a TV show. So I didn't know him very well at all. My second book came out the same year as his second book, which was in 1997. And we got to know each other a little bit professionally then as writers who were showing up at things. But we did not start dating until the year 2000. I think that was primarily because Baltimore is very small and I didn't want to meet anybody new.
At that point, was he involved with Hollywood?
He had just finished The Corner. That was one of the few things he did that got nominated for and won 3 Emmys, I believe. But he was in a lull. He didn't know what he was going to do next. Homicide was ending or had ended. He had done The Corner. And that was 2000. He was really beginning to wonder, well, what do I do now? He wrote a film script for Ron Howard that to this day hasn't been produced. Wrote that with a writing partner named Gene Weingarten for the Washington Post. But that, you know, brought money in and allowed him to sort of postpone any decisions about his future. Yeah, and then it happened that in the summer of 2001, this sudden hole opened up on the HBO schedule, and his agent called him and said, you know that cop show you're always talking about? You should write your Bible and write your first script because there's room for it.
Were you involved in any of the writing through those seasons?
No. I was recently, not exactly misquoted, but misrepresented because I made a joke that David stole more from me than I ever stole from him as writers, which means he stole, like, exactly one thing from me, which is the use of the farmer in the dell as Omar's song, which is something I had in a book at the time. I don't know how to write television. I occasionally just might, like, throw something out. The only time in the 5 seasons of The Wire that I remember having an idea was I remember there was a scene involving Stringer Bell, the drug lord who would be legitimate, waiting for the train to New York. And he's talking to a more conventional businessman. And in the initial scene, as I remember David describing it to me, Stringer Bell said something that was incredibly naive about finance. And I said, wouldn't it be more interesting if Stringer Bell knew about something very arcane about finance? I said, for example, I've been listening to all this stuff on NPR about the derivative market and how that screwed up Orange County. I said, I think it would be really interesting if Stringer Bell knew something about derivatives. And that's not what ended up. But I think, and I can't even swear to this in my memory, I do think that he, you know, took my idea that isn't it more interesting and surprising as Stringer Bell actually has a very sophisticated intellectual understanding of business, because as it will be revealed over the course of The Wire, while Stringer Bell is extremely sophisticated about the legitimate world, he's still ill-prepared, ill-equipped to enter it. It's crooked in ways that even he as a criminal can't quite fathom.
You see, what I'm thinking, here we've got someone, namely you, who has a lot of experience in plotting and the details of plot development. And I would think that surreptitiously, even if he didn't use your ideas to spin stuff off you, because you're the expert on the plots, you've got 18 books.
You have to remember that the writing staff for The Wire included George Pelecanos.
Oh, and Richard Price.
Richard Price and Dennis Lehane. They really had it covered. I mean, I will say that it was a very deliberate decision to bring in novelists. George Pelecanos was recruited to write for The Wire at the funeral of a dear friend, Paige Rose, who was one of the co-owners of the Mystery Bookstore in Baltimore, Maryland. It's my understanding that on the drive to the Shiva, that I was in a different car, but that David and George rode together, and David first pitched George the idea of The Wire. And then George was the one who went out and got Richard Price and got Dennis Lehane. These were his, I mean, I knew Dennis, but this was George's idea. But David endorsed it, as did his executive producer, Bob Colesbury, who would die very tragically at the beginning of season 3.
Laura Lippman, okay, so now Treme has been on. Have you been thinking about writing a book set in New Orleans?
No. New Orleans is a tough town. It has even more layers than Baltimore. Now, I write about my hometown. I grew up there, went away to school, and worked in Texas for a little while, which in some ways I feel gave me a very fresh perspective on Baltimore when I came back. It was good to step away for a while. I'm pretty critical of people who don't know Baltimore who try to write about it. Not that there are many novelists who do it, but I've seen some things over the years where people who really don't get Baltimore have tried to write about it. And I'm not going to be that person to New Orleans, which I actually consider more layered and more complicated, with just things I don't quite get yet. Like who talks to whom and who knows what. And
how come David feels competent to do that then?
I can't speak for him. He's been in love with New Orleans for a very long time and been going there for a very long time. And he's been in love with the music of New Orleans. And he's working with Eric Overmeyer, who lives part-time in New Orleans and lived part-time in New Orleans long before the show came along. It can be done. I'm not saying it can't be done. I'm saying I can't do it, and I can't do it well. You know, my work is really character driven. As much as place has played a big part and place is often called a character, that's true. But I think that how do I write about a place as a character if I don't know it really, really well, if I don't know all the ins and outs? I think if I had been a reporter in New Orleans, I would feel more comfortable. If I'd put in 10 years at the Times-Picayune, I'd probably begin to feel pretty comfortable putting the city in. I've written 2 short stories, and one of them is told from the point of view of tourists, so that doesn't really count. But it's complicated stuff. I remember, this is my favorite New Orleans story, is I was at a reception at a literary conference, and I heard a woman say, "The new maitre d' at Galatoire's, and by the way, he will be the new maitre d' at Galatoire's, even when he's been there 30 years. And I was like, bah, 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 bah. And I was like, to me, that, but that's not the whole of New Orleans. That's emblematic of one strand of New Orleans. And I don't really know where I fit in yet in New Orleans. I kind of travel in these different worlds. I live uptown, and I go to a gym with all these uptown ladies, but I'm not really one of them. I just happen to be on their same schedule and in their same neighborhood. I've gotten involved with a Mardi Gras crew, which was a really cool thing that happened. And I get to march in a Mardi Gras parade called Crew de Vue. And that's pretty extraordinary. And that's introduced me to different people, but tough town.
Laura Lippman, what's the status of the Tess Monahan series, the J. Cox Project?
TNT has just renewed the option. So that's good news. It means they want to keep their option on. I believe, if I'm correct, that Jay has written 2 versions of the pilot, that they wanted to see it at 2 different lengths. I can't remember if it was an hour and 2 hours, or an hour and 90 minutes, or 90 minutes and 2 hours. Jay's amazing. You know, one of the advantages of being married to someone who works in television is I don't think anyone could be more grounded about film and television than I am. I know how long the odds are against me. I know how tough it's going to be to get a show on the air. And then, you know, can it be a good show? And a lot of factors affect that are outside of your control. So I'm pretty easygoing. I have never asked to write a treatment of anything that I've sold to Hollywood. Don't want to do it. Don't think I'd do it very well. You know, maybe I could learn to write a screenplay, but I'm not going to take apart one of my own children to see if I can put that together. So that's where that is. And there are 2 film options on my work. The book I'd Know You Anywhere was optioned, and that really hasn't moved forward, but it's a relatively recent option. And then Frances McDormand, who optioned the book Every Secret Thing, has made incredible progress. We have a script, we have a director, we have a star. Need some money. That I am cautiously hopeful about, because Frances McDormand has told me that she really does think one day she will get it made.
And When She Was Good would probably work as a screenplay.
You would think. When it first started going around Hollywood, it was still in galleys, and the Lifetime series, the client list had just started. And so I think there was an initial reaction of, well, this is already being done. Now that people are reading the book, let's not kid ourselves about it. Why are they reading it again? Well, they're reading it again because Janet Maslin gave it a very strong review in the New York Times, and she carries a lot of weight in Hollywood as the former film critic of the New York Times. I think people are seeing that it's different from the client list.
Laura Lippman, what are you working on now? Have you finished a book that's in galleys and ready to go after this one?
Finished it? No. It's not due until January, so that's my excuse. Working on an idea that it was suggested to me by my husband. He was talking about this to me for years, and I had to find my own way into it, and I don't think I'm going in the direction that he would have had me go. I'm writing a novel inspired by the disappearance of Julia Salisbury. People who have ever seen Barry Levinson's Liberty Heights have seen one version of this story. Julia Salisbury was, in the 60s, the big sports book numbers runner in Baltimore City. He lived a very conventional suburban life with a wife and 3 daughters, but he also had a mistress, Pam Gale, who was a stripper on the block. He was convicted of, I believe it was mail fraud, and given an unusually harsh sentence of 15 years by the feds, allegedly because they held a grudge because they believed he had bribed crooked IRS agents who had come to him earlier. So one day, while out on appeal and under house arrest, he disappeared. He left the country through Canada. Where he eventually went is unknown. No one in his family ever broke their silence about it. He left behind a wife, three daughters, and a girlfriend. And I am working on a book about what happens when a retired detective who's now taking on cases as almost a consultant, doesn't carry a gun, doesn't carry a badge, this is based on someone I know in Baltimore, picks out his next cold case, and he is intrigued by the discovery that a former stripper who made herself respectable as an innkeeper disappeared in the mid-80s, was found in the 90s, and she is believed to be the last person who ever saw this man before he left the country.
And I know that you were in an episode of The Wire. So coming up on Treme, are we going to be able to see you in any episode?
I can say quite accurately that I received the worst reviews of my life for the one line that I said in The Wire. I think it was a bit overstated, but it was in the first episode of season 5. Some critics decided that my very appearance in that show was emblematic of things they didn't like about season 5. I don't want to be on Treme. There's no reason I would be on Treme. I do keep wondering when our daughter is going to get her shot on Treme. She's absolutely adorable. I'm very happy to be a stage mom. You know, I took her to the set to meet John Hyatt one day, and I just keep thinking certainly she's going to end up in the show. But no, I have retired from acting.
You've been listening to an interview with Laura Lippman, whose latest novel is And When She Was Good. I'm Richard Walensky on Cover to Cover.